The invitation.
Absolutely. Along with Bill Drees, reporter with the Daily Memphian. So President Rudd, you, like every school administrator, every university president, are faced with an incredibly, almost impossible decision in terms of reopening, the pressures to reopen, the pressures to stay safe. You all, as I understand, well, wait, I'll let you describe as you move towards an August 17th reopening, what is your plan for safety, for optimal learning, and so on?
So we are doing what a number of campuses around the country are doing. We're doing a phased return to the campus. And what that means is for the first 30 days, we are doing a monitoring period will be predominantly virtual. Now, we actually do have students on campus. We've actually had students on campus over the course of the summer. We've had students in housing over the course of the past 6 months throughout the entirety of COVID-19. We've had very strict measures in place for the management, for the monitoring of those individuals that are on our campus. Our campus is operating essentially at about 35 to 40% capacity right now. We're gonna maintain that density over the course of the next several weeks. If things improve, and when I say that, that means the number of total cases in Memphis, the overall positive diagnosis rate, as well as hospitalization, ICU, and access and availability of timely test results, we may, in September, increase the number of face-to-face classes that we have on campus.
Will you bring back, so for that month period, very few classes, if I understand it, very few classes in person, maybe certain labs, certain classes that just have to be done.
Labs, clinical training for areas like nursing, some limited work in engineering and the hard sciences that require exposure to specific equipment that we can't make available virtually or in someone's home, along with some limited performing arts opportunities for students as well.
In terms of residences, though, I can't remember the capacity. I should have looked it up. The total capacity of on-campus housing that you have, and are you going to limit that? I mean, even if kids are doing classes virtually, will some come in, live in the dorms, and do their classes from their dorms? And what are the percentages?
They will. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they will. We have, I think, a part of the unique role that we play in Memphis and in this community is we have a significant number of students who don't have adequate infrastructure at home. And that means to continue their educational experience virtually or remotely. So they need access to housing as a part of this. But we have had students in housing throughout the course of the past 6 months. Actually, at the height of COVID-19, when we moved many students out of dorms, we had about 750 students who had no place else to live. Continued in our housing. We'll increase that. Our capacity is about 22 to 2400. We recently took two facilities offline to use as quarantine facilities over the course of COVID-19. So our capacity is about 2,100, and we'll be close to that over the course of the coming months.
I see. One more question, I'll go to Bill. I assume you've had among those, because I'm old, those students who stayed on campus, I assume there have been some positive tests. I mean, what have your protocols been if you've gotten a student who's living there who's tested positive?
Yeah, we have. Well, actually, we have not had a student test positive. Yeah, interestingly enough, we are going to start adding our test data on our website. We've had 25 incidents, 25 positive diagnoses among students. They've all been in off-campus facilities. Now, what I would encourage everyone to remember and recognize and understand is that right next to our dorms, we have apartments with students in them.
Right.
And so we have facilities that surround our campus that are full of students that don't have the measures, the guidance, and the guidelines in place that we have for our facilities. So we've had 25 incidences, none of them in our facilities. When we have questions of exposure, though, Eric, we have had students, they have to move to the quarantine facility for 10 days in quarantine for that period of time, and then are monitored. We do symptom monitoring, symptom checks, and now we, as of this week, this coming week, we will have a testing center available on our campus.
All right, let me go to Bill.
Dr. Rudd, this is an incredibly complex undertaking, I think, for anyone who has an institution of that size. But are there elements of higher education that make this just a little bit easier than perhaps K through 12 education? I mean, you know, you have students coming in and going, which I suppose could be a hazard in one way, but in another way, it prevents a really large gathering that you might see at a K through 12 school.
Yeah, I think some of the differences between us and K through 12, one is that in K through 12, kids come into classrooms and are in those classrooms for 8 to 9 hours a day. You know, when we have a class, those classes are from 50 minutes to a small seminar could be 3 hours. So the duration of exposure is dramatically different in an elementary school, a junior high or high school than it is in a university environment. Our capacity to manage and monitor with adults, I would argue, is a little bit more effective. And we have a little bit easier time with that. And then the other thing I'd mention, Bill, I think that's critical, is our IT infrastructure is dramatically better. We simply have an IT infrastructure and capacity among faculty that they can make that transition very easily. So even if data continue to improve, and in early middle September, we return voluntarily some classes, some small classes to campus, they'll be hybrid classes. So students that have qualifying conditions, other concerns, family members that they're worried about exposure, they can continue those classes remotely while some of the students are face-to-face. So, mm-hmm. You know, at the heart of it is our IT infrastructure is, I think, remarkably good.
What is the nature of the digital divide at the University of Memphis? Because it sounds like it's quite different than what we're seeing and frankly what we've talked more about in like Shelby County Schools example.
Yeah, I think for us, you know, we have, I remind people that 51% of our students qualify for Pell Grants or Pell eligible, which means they have very significant financial challenges. And what that means is that they have limitations on their ability to continue their education remotely. That is why our housing is so critical. They need access to infrastructure, access to some equipment, access to different elements to be able to, that includes Wi-Fi coverage, to be able to continue their education even if it is remotely. That's why our housing is such a critical element and a critical piece for a large percentage of our students. And as a result, we make it available. Now, the good part for us is we've actually had good experience over the course of the past 6 months in managing, monitoring that, and our capacity to respond quickly to that. I think we've demonstrated that we can do it effectively.
Mm-hmm. For the students who live just beyond the borders of the campus and may live in housing where there are not the precautions that there should be, does the university talk to the landlords there about that?
We do. We certainly do. We coordinate with those housing facilities. As I'd mentioned, we've had 25 incidents over the course of the summer. Every single one of those was off campus. And we make every effort to coordinate. I would continue to be concerned about it. That is a part of why we made the decision to start remotely and virtually at the beginning of the fall, is concern about that exposure and then bringing that infection onto campus and exposure for faculty and staff. After the spring this last year, when we decided to move virtually as many campuses did, every single case that we had on our campus actually came from outside of the campus onto the campus. So people brought it back. So that's why our monitoring and testing up front, again, will be critical as we continue to try to manage infection.
Mm-hmm. And before I go back to Eric, what do you hear from students about this experience? I mean, college is especially for your freshmen, college is a transition. This is a little bit more than they bargained for, I would imagine.
Yeah, no, it is. And I hear a lot of frustration, and I would tell you a very appropriate frustration about their experience. Most of our students, I would tell you that significant majority of our students have done remarkably well with the transition to virtual and remote learning. We actually, if you look at academic performance, our students actually outperformed in the spring and in the summer relative to the previous year. If you look at student evaluations of faculty, they actually assessed and evaluated faculty higher in the spring and the summer than they did the previous year. So overall, they've recognized, and I think been very complimentary of the faculty and staff and their ability to respond, but they're frustrated about those elements of education that are lacking. And that a lot of that is, the activities outside of the classroom, informal learning, exposure to other students, and opportunities with faculty and staff outside of the classroom.
Just to talk a little bit about the video, I think you all have had a pretty robust video online offering pre-COVID, right? I mean, I have a number of friends who are instructors, faculty there, and they tend to have, it seems like part of their class load almost always includes at least one video. That may be just anecdotal, but this is not new to you.
This is not new. We've been into it almost about three decades for the university. And we have probably 60, I think we've got now over 70 programs that are fully online, that you can get a degree fully online through U of M Global. And most of those programs are nationally ranked.
Let's talk a bit about the numbers and students. I mean, you know, university is first and foremost an academic institution. It's also, I mean, it is a business of sorts, right? I mean, there are revenue and expenses and all that you and your staff have to manage. That starts, I assume, with how many students are returning for this fall semester and how many new students are coming in. I mean, we've heard a lot anecdotally of people saying, well, my son, my daughter, they're gonna take a year off. They're not gonna go. We don't necessarily wanna pay the big price to have them do, you know, online learning. Has that hit your numbers in terms of students returning and new students?
I think a couple things in response to that. One, I would remind people that, you know, our annual tuition and fee cost is under $10,000 a year. Relative to, you know, many private institutions, the annual cost is in the high $40,000 to $50,000 per year. You essentially can get a degree for us for the cost of tuition for 1 year at some of those institutions. So transition to online for us is a little different given the dramatic differences in cost. So I would argue we are remarkably cost efficient as an institution. In the spring, Eric, we absorbed $27 million in losses. We are not a business, but we are an enterprise. We have to be able to respond to these financial issues. If you look from the spring into the summer, it probably is in the ballpark of $40 million in terms of total losses that we absorb as an institution. Now, we've done that without furloughs and without layoffs. And, the money that we received from the CARES Act, about $15.8 million, we distributed almost all of that either directly in support payments to students or in scholarshiping support to students. We have absorbed significant losses over the course of the spring. We are well positioned moving into the fall. We actually, our enrollment in the summer was up 18% year over year. So yeah, we had significant, but we also had incentives. So we had scholarshiping incentives and others to have students continue in these difficult times and stay on pace for graduation. As of today, we're down a couple percentage points, but we have a significant number of students in line for advising and enrollment over the course of the next couple of weeks. We look like we'll be relatively even. Our freshman numbers for registration, we actually, for our one online virtual orientation for new freshmen, this was a record. We have exceeded last year's numbers by over 300 students, and last year was a record year for us. So We're a little bit down a couple of percentage points today, but we think we'll make that up over the course of the next couple of weeks.
What sort of, we'll shift to sports, which there is pressure there, right? I mean, there's pressure there for the experience, for the role of the U of M in Memphis. There's financial pressure. I think, if I'm not mistaken, AAC, the conference, the athletic conference you all are in, announced that they're going to attempt to do a full schedule of football games. What do sports look like at the U of M this fall? And how much pressure are you feeling to get sports going? I won't say at all costs, but how much pressure do you feel?
I'm actually the chair of the President's Council for the American Athletic Conference. We met yesterday and made a decision to go ahead and move forward with football for this coming year, and to allow universities to open training camps and move forward with the season. We'll do a conference schedule, plus each institution can do their out-of-conference schedule as they would like, up to a maximum of four games. Over the course of the last month, since football and basketball players have returned for voluntary workouts and individual activity, it's been managed very effectively. So we're hopeful that we can manage it well. We recognize and understand that it is going to be a significant challenge, and we'll respond immediately in order to protect the safety and health of all of those student athletes. So that will continue to be at the forefront. We recognize their financial challenges, but as I told our campus a couple of weeks ago when we decided to take the first 30 days virtually, review data and respond, we're going to continue to put the health and safety of people at the forefront.
So if we look right now at the professional leagues, you know, the NBA went with the $175 million bubble down in Florida, where there's essentially a kind of quarantine going on. That's obviously unbelievably expensive, and it takes that sort of pro money to make that happen. But I mean, the cautionary tale seems to be professional baseball, where numerous teams now have had many positive cases. That has then had the practical effect of shutting down games and really just disrupting the schedule. Will you all, let's just stick with football, will you all be testing every week or on a regular basis? And could that, I mean, if there are positive cases, either an opponent's team or the U of M, will that cause games to be canceled?
It would, and we will be testing on a regular basis. The NCAA released guidelines, I believe yesterday, may have been the day before yesterday, on expectations. And what you saw yesterday was Division II and Division III decided not to have fall sports. At the heart of that is that Division II and Division III decided they could not essentially follow those guidelines. Some of that is cost, that following those testing guidelines is a relatively significant investment. But at the Division I level, most universities are making that investment. We've made that investment in the conference, in the American Athletic Conference, and we'll continue to do that. I won't be surprised, Eric, consistent with what you said, if we have some games that are canceled as a part of this. I think that is simply the reality of the data. Now, the last week in Memphis, we've actually seen some decline in positive test rate as well as overall daily cases. Hopefully that will continue. If people will follow guidance, we can actually get this in a manageable framework, but it is critical for people simply to follow behavioral guidance.
Looking ahead to basketball, when does basketball start? Is it gonna start on time?
That has yet to be addressed. And so that we have not discussed that. We've really been a little bit overwhelmed with just the reality of trying to launch football along with campus issues, I think, for all of us in the conference.
Yeah, let me go over to Bill.
Dr. Rudd, your backdrop is game day, which, as we were talking before we went on, seems like a million years ago and crowds like that. Let me ask you about on the other side of this pandemic, whenever that is. Is higher education different as a result of what we've been through?
No question about it. I think higher education is profoundly different on the other side of this. I don't know that I've encountered anyone that would argue to the contrary. And I think at the heart of that is going to be a careful and thoughtful evaluation about cost of higher education, containing cost of higher education. I would argue we have worked incredibly hard here over the last 7 years to contain cost. We have had the lowest cost increases in Tennessee by far. We've had 4 out of 7 years with no tuition increase. And I think you're going to see a lot of students nationally. And they're saying that today, and certainly I would argue it's something that needs to be asked about the significant cost at some institutions and how we manage that moving forward. Those are great questions, good questions, and I think thoughtful responses are going to be required.
Mm-hmm. Back to sports for just a second. What is the Liberty Bowl crowd going to look like for football?
Well, we are actually still working on that. So our athletic director, Laird Veach, offered a communication yesterday to our season ticket holders and started that conversation. We'll have that worked out over the course of the next couple of weeks. It depends on a number of things. I mean, one of the things it depends on is current data regarding infection rates and spread in Memphis specifically. And hopefully we will get some flexibility in the coming weeks. We're moving in the right direction. Hopefully that will continue. If that does continue in the right direction, we'll have a little bit larger crowds. I would be stunned if it approaches more than 20% capacity at the Liberty Bowl in these early stages. I would be surprised to see that. And 20% capacity is in the ballpark of about 15,000. And that's a very large crowd in these current circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Bill mentioned the future and the future of higher ed. And we've had this conversation, you and I, or I think in part because our kids are similar ages and just, you know, the costs of, thankfully I have one who's done with a very expensive school. I have another one in the midst of a very expensive school. And it is a different consideration when you're looking at these huge, huge ticket prices to do online learning. And I hear that from lots of places. Also, we're in a recession, right? I mean, we're in an economic downturn of whose depth is not yet clear because we don't know how we're gonna come back and when, but it's bad and it's gonna go on. Do you all, I mean, I don't mean this in a callous way, but do you all look to take advantage of these dynamics and what U of M has to offer in terms of the cost, but also the experience relative to some of these other incredibly high priced places?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's an opportunity for us to share what I would argue is an excellent education and a highly cost effective education. You know, I've told students, and I'll continue to share that message that you can get a great education here. And if you want to go to graduate school, professional school, any kind of postgraduate training, you can go from Memphis to anywhere in the country. We have students that graduate each and every year and go to some of the most outstanding top 10 programs across a broad domain of areas for graduate training. And you can start that career, you can start that pathway, you can start that trajectory right here in Memphis and do it for a dramatically lower cost.
Do over the past few years, U of M under your leadership has been trying to enhance its residential experience, I think, right? I mean, building dorms that you all owned, you know, their outside companies have come in and built near campus, if not on campus housing. The Highland Row, which was always a place to go, but there's a lot of investment in the physical infrastructure around the school to make it more of a destination, less of a commuter and more of a destination residential campus. Does this coronavirus, this pandemic and all this separating give you pause in terms of that planning? Or do you look past this and say that's still the future for the U of M?
Yeah, we certainly look past it. This is a short-term problem. And one of the things that we have talked very specifically about is we don't want to make decisions in this short-term window that have long-term impact unnecessarily. And so we have continued our building projects, construction projects. Those are funded differently. Those are not operational funds. We can only spend those dollars on construction. We'll complete our student recreation center this year. We just started yesterday, actually, doing the prep work for construction and breaking ground on the new music performance facility. We're doing the planning for a just funded new science building, and we'll announce very shortly, Eric, consistent with what you said, a new private partnership for some new student housing. So all of those things will move forward. This is a temporary problem that we'll have appropriate health treatment and vaccine care for in the coming year, and we're moving forward.
All right, that is all the time we have this week. Thank you for joining us. Remember, you can get past episodes of Behind the Headlines on WKNO.org, or you can download the full podcast of the show from the Daily Memphian site, wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you again next week.